Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Most people tend to mark the beginning of Indian international relations thought to Nehru and his attempts to build a true non-aligned movement and a more enlightened international system. But Indian thought international relations didn't emerge sui generis after Indian independence. As Rahul Sagar notes in his edited anthology, To Raise a Fallen People, the 19th Century Origins of Indian Views on International Politics, published this year by Columbia University Press. Rahul collects writings from Indian thinkers on a variety of topics: the threat posed by Russia, the value of free trade, discrimination faced by Indians at home and overseas, showing the diversity of views present in Indian political debate long before 1945. Rahul Sagar is a Global Network Associate Professor of Political Science at New York University Abu Dhabi. His books include Secrets and Leaks, The Dilemma of State Secrecy, and The Progressive Maharaja, Sir Madhavi Rao's Hints on the Art and Science of Government. Today, Rahul and I talk about these collected writings and what they tell us about India then, and perhaps India today. So, Rahul, thanks so much for joining me on the Asian Review Books podcast. You know, let's start with maybe an obvious question. You know, why collect this anthology? What's important about 19th century Indian writing that we're missing?
Nicholas, thanks so much for having me. And thanks for that nice broad opening question. The reason I collected these essays is really twofold. The first is to show, as you started out with, that there was a lot going on in India intellectually and politically before 1947 about international politics. The general view, the conventional view until really very recently, was that there was not really much said or done about international politics before independence, because Indians were primarily concerned with trying to obtain freedom and resolving social and economic inequities at home. So they were focused primarily on domestic politics and concerns. That was the conventional view. And in the last few years, there's been important work done that pushes the story back a couple of decades to the 1920s and 1930s, showing how prominent figures traveled, participated in international events, and sort of developed a wider view. And maybe the earliest this goes back to someone like Gandhi and his views on international relations in maybe the 1920s. What I've tried to show is that actually those developments and discoveries and what we think about as the foundations of India's view of the world are much deeper and go back much further, more than a century, in fact. And so that's the first thing, just as a matter of fact, as a matter of empirical record, I wanted to show that there was, in fact, a lot out there. Speeches, debates, essays, articles, reportage, travelogues, petitions, pamphlets, all of these are things that I've collected and sorted and sifted through to present this overview of what was actually happening a whole century before we usually think India started thinking about international politics. And the second reason I made this effort is, aside from just correcting the record, which is, I guess, important enough in itself, but I wanted to show something more than that. I wanted to show that when we look back at the 19th century and we see what Indians were saying and doing, how they were reacting to a changing international system and the intensity and immensity of global power conflict, global power competition in the 19th century, we see the kernel of how they came to and are now responding to international tensions and conflict and competition. So the 19th century is important not just because it tells us Indians were thinking, but it tells us what they were thinking about international politics back then was influential. It still affects us today.
So maybe you could remind us kind of what India's place in the British Empire was at this time. You know, how much authority, how much autonomy did it have within the empire, and how, I guess, what was the imperial government that kind of ruled India? Well, how was that structured?
Yeah, so there are two broad phases. The great deciding event is the 1857 mutiny or revolution, which then produces crown government from the center, from the metropolis after 1858. But in the period before that, in the first half of the 19th century, India is ruled partly through the East India Company and partly through Parliament, which oversees the East India Company and sets various bounds and laws that the East India Company has to live up to. And in the first half of the 19th century, the company is still settling its control and its structures and institutions and processes. The great achievement for the company, from their perspective, is that between 1800 and 1820, they complete their hegemony over much of the sort of the central landmass of the continent. They have everything from Delhi all the way down to modern day Kerala, either directly under their control or through a system of what they call subsidiary alliances, which are basically dependencies that give up their foreign and trade policies and their international links. All of these can only be routed through the British. The British have to agree to delegations, to travel, to trade arrangements, to pacts or trade agreements, things of that kind. So between 1800 and 1858, you get this gradual concentration of international control in the hands of the company, which deprives, either directly or indirectly, Indians of agency in the international arena. And after 1858, the crown takes over. And then there's a further interesting change. If the first half of the century had been the company just simply trying to gain control of and putting in place systems and processes, building out a bureaucracy that came to be called the Indian Civil Service, modernizing and recruiting the Indian military, which had worked on more feudal lines before the company appeared. All of these things are sort of set into motion and are reasonably well developed by 1858. But once the crown takes over and rule is ultimately out of London, then Indian foreign policy, Indian military policy, Indian economic policy becomes subservient to broader British objectives. And then you start to see Indian troops or Indian trade arrangements or Indian resources being used, or indeed Indians themselves in their physical bodies when they're used as indentured labor in other British colonies. You see India being pulled into, attached to, connected to the global economy and the global political, the international system, I should say, in all sorts of new and dramatically different ways.
So on reading some of the essays, writings in this collection, I was struck by how some essays were quite flattering towards the British and the British Empire. I think one can ask how sincere that flattery was. You know, it could have been a deliberate effort to make a political point or an effort to, I guess, getting close with the imperial authorities. But I guess from that observation, it shifts me to my question, which is kind of who were the intended audience, or who was the intended audience for these pieces? Where were they published? Who were these various writers writing for?
Yeah, that gets to the heart of why this anthology is important. So these figures were what were called at the time, and pardon the gendered language, it fit with the sociology of the time, representative men, which meant they were the figures that voiced the ideas, the worldviews, the sentiments, the emotions and reactions of educated metropolitan India. And what I mean by that is, starting in the early 19th century, not just by British agency, but for a variety of reasons, Indians recognize that they've been colonized because they have failed to cultivate the kinds of technologies, ideas, resources, communal and communitarian attachments, patriotism, all those sorts of things that would have made them able to resist external invasion and aggression. And so they rush to be educated in modern ways, especially in science, but also through English, have access to all sorts of other kinds of knowledge, geographic, commercial, and political. And so they demand, they petition for the creation of schools and colleges and universities, which they get gradually every decade from the 1820s onwards, sees a steady expansion in the number of these institutions. And by the 1850s and 60s, Indians then begin to mimic what they see their teachers doing in these institutions, almost all of whom are English or British. What they see is these figures living the high life of Victorian England in the intellectual sense, taking part in public debate, discussion, writing in periodicals, giving speeches and debating in clubs and societies, the ideas and policies of the day. And they begin to mimic these. And because they're often excluded, almost always excluded from British periodicals, partly for racial reasons, partly because of their uncertain grasp over the finer points of the English language or things of that kind. Because they're excluded, they begin to then publish journals of their own. And many of these essays that I found are in these journals because these journals can be distributed across the country. They are more immediate. It's they address policies that matter for that set of months or that year. Unlike books, they don't require vast amounts of resources to write, to publish, to distribute. And because they're in English, they can circulate easily across the country, regardless of vernacular or local linguistic differences. And so these figures who are writing in these periodicals, writing these essays, are representative of, in some ways, what's finest about the Indian reaction to colonialism. And that's why, as you said, they sometimes seem appreciative or they seem flattering. They recognize that what the colonial, for better or for worse, what the colonial experience has given them is a chance to come to grips with modernity. And they seize it with both hands. And so they are, in that sense, grateful might be too strong a word, but they acknowledge that this, as they call it often, providence has brought them to this moment. And then they decide to make the most of it. And they do that by starting to read widely, travel, engage in debate and discussion, both written and spoken, and thereby refining ideas that really prepare them to then lead in the 20th century a much more activist public life, where they demand things, because now they've started to understand them.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of other kind of modernization campaigns throughout Asia. You know, I'm thinking of Japan, I'm thinking of China, which have this kind of similar, I mean, and obviously the balance is different, but they have a similar kind of love-hate relationship with Western knowledge, Western culture, Western power. I mean, how did Indian intellectuals, Indian elites at this time, you know, see Britain as a source of knowledge, as a source of culture, as a source of power? How did they kind of, I mean, you have chapters in the book kind of like what can Indians learn from the West and what can the rest of the world learn from India, I think, at the very end of your book.
Yeah, that's the great debate, in a sense, particularly towards the end of the 19th century, as Indians look back and reflect, and what's the insight or the learning that they take with them into the 20th century, is this question about whether they really learned something useful from the West, from this encounter, encounter with imperialism and with Western modernity. And so you're exactly right. You see a very, very similar trajectory in China and Japan. In many ways, India's first in the story because it's colonized first. English education gets to and is accepted in India many decades before the same thing happens both in Japan and then in China. So India in some ways is a really interesting case for a wide audience to think about and reflect on, for an Asian audience to reflect on at least, because you see the very first set of reactions to to Western modernity. And then what are those reactions, and how does that connect up with the second part of your question? In the first half of the century, as we were just discussing, Indians are appreciative, or at least see that they have an opening that they can take advantage of. And they're really prepared to take advantage of the British. They don't see themselves as powerless, defenseless, naive, or unthinking, or as slaves. They see themselves as creatively, cleverly constructing new identities and ways of being in response to the challenges they face. So they adapt. They don't react by by turning inwards and becoming a shell. They don't react violently or forcefully and suggest everything in modernity is corrupt and should be resisted. Instead, they try to take what they have, take the old, see what if it is meaningful under modern circumstances, especially when exposed to science and scientific thinking, and then to fashion new ways of being in the world, new identities, including this broader sense of an Indian national identity that sits above any other pre-existing regional or local identities. So the first half of the century sees Indians much more, appreciative of the benefits of Western modernity. And then the story starts to change. In the second half of the 19th century, as Indians reflect on what they've learned and what the West is actually doing, often in other parts, for example, the opium trade, or the forceful opening up of Japan, or the colonization of the Philippines, or the settling of indentured labor in Malaya and Singapore. All of these events and activities make them begin to doubt the things that they were appreciative of in the first half of the 19th century. They say to themselves, well, all of this is great to learn about modern science, but if the purpose of modern science is to make warfare more efficient and effective, is it really a good thing? They also start to wonder if all of these claims that they hear about liberalism, the high Victorian morality of individuality and progress, if any of these things really mean much when they see the British mistreating not just Indians, but other races around the world and in other colonies, as they travel, as they go through Japan, as they go through Hong Kong and Shanghai, as they travel, of course, to Canada and so on, they see how unequal the Western world treats people of other races. And it starts to engender a kind of skepticism that later turns into hostility. So you get these two kinds of reaction at the end of the 19th century, which I think is also seen in China and Japan. One saying our culture is actually more moral, it's more spiritual, it's higher. And another saying the West is simply hypocritical and we need something else, we need something better. And in the 20th century, those two things turn into a sort of Indian, the first with figures like Gandhi, turn into an Indian spiritualism that resists Western modernity and materialism. And the second, you turns into Indian connections with global socialism and global communism, saying the West is corrupt, but we can do better. We have to find a global answer to the problems of power and inequality. And so it's from that reaction in the 19th century that you get these two big trends in the 20th century that are so associated with India.
You know, there are so many different topics that your anthology covers. But I'm going to maybe start from your mention of the opium trade in China, because you have several chapters in your book that deal with India's or Indian views towards countries that weren't Britain. You have a chapter on China, you have a chapter on Turkey, and you have a chapter on Russia, specifically kind of the military threat posed by Russia to Central Asia and to India. And so I wonder if you might talk a bit more about how India saw these other powers, maybe with more attention on Russia, given that seemed to have the clearest point to talk about for Indian writers, which was the potential military threat posed by the country.
Yeah, the awareness of other countries and international politics starts to really only grow in a very decisive way after the 1870s, because that's when Indians who are educated and well off in the metropolitan parts of the country are able to summon up the courage to travel overseas and challenge the existing sort of taboos against against leaving India's shores. As they begin to travel, you start to find them in places like Germany, in Russia, in Turkey, of course, in England and Western Europe, but also later in the United States and Japan as advances in steam shipping make these journeys more manageable and faster, more predictable. So you start to see Indians spreading widely. And by the last two decades of the 19th century, they're writing about a whole range of countries. They're writing about Japan with particular fascination because Japan is moving much more rapidly than India is because it isn't colonized in the same way. Japan is moving rapidly towards modernity, and they're greatly astonished and mostly admiring of Japan's revolution after the Meiji. And so they eagerly report on cases such as this. In other places, their links depend on particular identity. So, for example, Turkey is of much greater importance because it's at that point the center of the caliphate. It's of much greater importance to Muslim writers and travelers than to those of other communities. Similarly, Christians travel much more either as missionaries in training or as recent converts, travel much more to England or the United States in particular than they would to sort of, you know, Eastern Europe or to Russia or something of that kind or to Japan. So you get different sorts traveling to different places. The one country, you were exactly right, that really compels them, that everyone is compelled to take very seriously and think about, is Russia, because when the great game, this geopolitical contest between Russia and Britain begins to expand it runs all the way from 1820 up till 1893, but the first 20 or 30 decades of the contest are relatively unnoticed in India because Russia is still very far away. It's still working its way through Central Asia. But by the 1870s, it's approaching Afghanistan. And in the 1880s, it gets there, right to the very tip. And so then Indians suddenly start to take the story very seriously because most of the prior invasions of India, apart from the British, or I should say the European powers, the British, the Dutch, the Portuguese, etc., the European powers came by sea. But prior invasions had come in from the northwest. And so when Russia reaches Afghanistan, Indians suddenly sit up very straight and start to take the matter very seriously, especially when it becomes clear that England is really not prepared for this kind of contest. England runs a relatively small military establishment in India because so many Indian native states are willing to work with the British. They don't actually require immense military power to maintain order. And so the British are somewhat under-equipped. They're distracted by other geopolitical objectives elsewhere in the world that soak up their resources, whether it's in Egypt or Turkey, etc. And so there's this anxiety in India. Might we actually be invaded? Might the British actually be expelled? What should we make of this entire situation? What do we think of the Russian political system? And so for about a 20-year period between 1870 and 1890, Indians have to really fundamentally confront the nature and character of international politics. Is it fine that this country is simply invading, this country being Russia, is invading and occupying country after country as it works its way towards Afghanistan and would turn up in England? Should we welcome them simply because they might lead to the expulsion of the British? What if they're worse? Which is what many of the Indian liberals worry about. And they say that Indians should support the British on grounds of value. They don't think the British are in India for the good of Indians, but they think Indians are better off under the British than they would be under the Russians. And then there are other radicals and revolutionaries who simply have the view that we should take great advantage of the fact that the Russians are bearing down, the instability that they would create, would open up an opportunity for us to expel the British. So you get different sorts of responses. You get Indians traveling to Russia and then writing for Indian newspapers from Russia, or I should say writing after they're expelled from Russia, about how frightening and dictatorial the Russian political system is, and how much better it is to live in live under English rule, where at least you can complain in some measure. So you get these really remarkable sets of essays going both ways, questioning and challenging what Indians should do. And it's their first great moment in the 19th century where they really confront international politics in its bare form.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I want to end with Gandhi's essay on South Africa. And he's writing, he's clearly highlighting a particular injustice on how Indians are being treated in South Africa, being denied certain rights, certain privileges. But on reading it, and I know this is early Gandhi. This isn't the Gandhi that became famous as a spiritual and political leader decades later. But one can't shake the feeling that he's upset that Indians aren't getting the same privileges as Europeans. Maybe less so about the whole racial structure in South Africa itself. Maybe that's an unfair reading, and you can correct me. But I did want to end on that particular essay, given the prominence that Gandhi now has in talking about Indian political history.
Yeah, it is a difficult part of the story for Gandhi's thought in particular. He does so let me take one step back and reflect on why he is so worried about Indians, why he's so centrally focused on Indians being treated as equals. And this has something to do with the origins of liberal or international thinking in India in the latter part of the 19th century, the early part of the 20th century, which are the sort of formative influences on Gandhi. And Indians are reacting to the promises made to them after 1858 that they are subjects of Queen Victoria, that they are members of this larger British Empire, and that, like other members of the British Empire, they will be cultivated, encouraged, fostered, they will progress. And eventually, in some way, as they hoped throughout the 19th century, particularly in the latter part of the 19th century, they hoped that they will have representative government. And so Gandhi is his pleas and his cries for justice are coming from that background, where Indians expected, by virtue of quote unquote civilizing themselves, right? Learning English, he's a lawyer, he's gone to the inner temple, so he's mastered the intricacies of British constitutionalism and so on. If this person and or people like this can't be treated as equals, then who will ever be? So it's sort of coming from this plaintive cry that, look, we've met these criteria of wealth, education, background, upbringing, ability of various kinds, and yet we are not treated as equal. So that's the part I would sort of say partially or partly as a kind of defense for his perspective. And then I think there's a second part, which is, well, one would, you know, hope you would go beyond that to see broader affinities in the suffering of others and a broader critique of a highly inegalitarian racial structure. And I think here Gandhi is not unlike many other nationalities or thinkers of the 19th century, still thinking of a world in which race, ethnicity, and even class they put a horizon to your thinking. So you will assume that people from China think, see, feel, act a particular way. And you will say the Japanese, or you will say, you know, the Chinese. And so you get this sort of idea that, look, we're arguing for our group, community, association, unit. And what happens to others is for them to argue about, because each one of us is so different. So in a sense, I guess what I'm trying to say is the more universalistic ideas that start to then appear about a decade or two after Gandhi writes this essay, those are not yet quite there in circulation in the late 1900s when Gandhi's writing this essay and giving these speeches about how Indians are treated in South Africa. There tends to be more of a regional, racial, ethnic kind of horizon. That changes both for Gandhi and for India in general as the 20th century rolls around and many, many more Indians begin traveling. And they begin traveling to more unusual destinations, not just London, but they start traveling to Eastern Europe, they start traveling to Latin America, and of course they start traveling to many other colonized parts of Asia. And that gives them the realization. And of course, I can't forget the large migrations to places like the Caribbean and East Africa and South Pacific. All of these make them aware of the similarities of the imperial experience of subjugation across races, and in the broader awakening that happens across the world. In the wake of especially the First World War, this sense that we all belong to this larger family of nations and the family of mankind, and we have this broader identity above race or pan-race. Our races don't divide us. As that thinking spreads, then, of course, Indians become deeply interested in and invested in broader movements that are against racism, that are against imperialism, and so on. But that takes a few decades and comes a little later. And so I hope that helps, this background helps explain something about why Gandhi has what look like blinkers in the 19th century.
You know, us talking about how kind of thought develops over time, thought develops history, kind of is maybe a good segue to my very last question, which is, you know, I mean, it's how do these writings in the 19th century, how does Indian discussion about international relations, about free trade, which we didn't get into in our conversation, about power, about race, about cultural influence, how do these conversations influence the development of Indian international relations thought post-independence and to the present day? Now, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, our India's diplomats today, are they reading writings like this? Probably not. But as no diplomat probably is reading 19th century writings from American or British European thinkers of that type too. That's just not how they operate. But how are conversations from the 19th century, these Indian conversations, influencing how India sees itself in the world, sees itself as part of the international system, how India thinks about foreign policy today?
Yeah, you know, there's two kinds of transmission mechanisms. One is not entirely far removed from the speculation you just had, which is there are still decision makers in India from the prime minister down who will read and think about important figures from the 19th century and be at least conversant with it. They might not read or have the time. They certainly have the intellect, but they may not have the time to read them at great length, or they may have read them a few decades ago. But I think that there's a general familiarity with some key figures. They don't have the full spectrum. That's why I wrote the book, to introduce them to this much wider array of voices, or remind them of them, bring them to their notice. So they're not aware of the full range or spectrum, the depth of the debates and discussions of the 19th century, but they have an openness and some awareness of at least a few key figures, particularly towards the very end of the 19th century, people like Vivekananda or Gokhale and figures like that, precursors, forerunners to Gandhi and others. Dadabhai Naoroji, who plays a key role in for example, critiques of inequitable trade. Most Indians will have heard of him and be familiar with his broad ideas, though he's only one of many voices on this subject. So there are some transmission networks that are like that are just direct, where people have some awareness of particular figures. But I think it's the second transmission mechanism that I'm most interested in, and why I think we really need to read and think about the 19th century. It's that the figures in the 19th century marked a decisive break with everything that had come before, because there was a change in language from Persian and Urdu and Arabic and Sanskrit and even regional languages towards English, which became sort of the lingua franca. And with English, an introduction to new ideas, debates and discussions, as we've been discussing for this last half hour, that really brought India into a global conversation. Indians began to think not so much about how one principality takes over another, or how one religion contests another, but they started to think about states and international actors and alliances and so on at the global, at the international level. So the 19th century is a major turning point intellectually and materially. A nation state appears where previously there had been a collection of many different smaller principalities or native states. So the 19th century is unique. And the founders of Indian institutions, associations, universities, colleges, political organizations, debating clubs and societies, newspapers, magazines, all of these occurred in the 19th century. And they therefore almost inevitably ended up shaping and forming the ideas and the worldviews of people in the early 20th century. And those are the ones who led India to independence. And so the 19th century has this second transmission mechanism of literally ideas flowing through peoples and institutions, leaders and institutions, in this very visceral way. It is not hundreds of years ago, but literally the founders of the National Congress, who help bring the country to independence in 47, are all reading and writing in the same journals. It's quite a remarkable set of threads that tie them together. So that's the transmission mechanism. And then what is it that transmission mechanism sends forward? In my book, I try and say that the one great question that was never answered in the 19th century and wasn't answered in the 20th century and still lives with us today and is being now answered is the question of what should India's reaction be to global power politics. In the 19th century, Indians lived under the shadow of empire. They had limited ability to actually enact policy. They could debate it and question it, but they didn't have to resolve or settle the debate because their hand was not on the levers of power. And in the 20th century, when their hand finally got on the lever of power, there was already a Cold War underway that sort of locked global competition into two camps, and then that was it. And so India made its choice to sort of straddle or sit in the middle of the two camps and undertake this policy called non-alignment, which really allowed it to defer the question of what it makes of international politics. Now, as we enter a world that is multipolar, in which India has abilities of its own that it didn't have when it became independent, when it has a large population and a large economy and a set of global connections that are much more like what it had at the beginning of the 19th century, then it really becomes a question once again: what kind of power does India want to be? What kind of decisions does it want to make? What capabilities and capacities does it want to cultivate? What kinds of norms does it want to support or oppose? So the debates of the 19th century are deeply important to us because we are, in fact, now starting to answer the questions that were asked then. That's the that's the kind of crucial importance of this book and these essays.
So I think with that, that ends our interview with Rahul Sagar, author of To Raise a Fallen People, The 19th Century Origins of Indian Views on International Politics. Rahul, I actually have two more questions for you to finish things off. And those questions are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What's the next project?
Thanks so much, Nicholas. Yeah, so the book is available widely. It's available with Columbia University Press, both on their website and on Amazon.com. And it's there's also an Indian edition of the book published by Juggernaut Press, and that's available with Amazon India. And as for myself, I'm now working on a new book that will be ready by the end of this year and will hopefully come out next year, the middle of next year. And it traces the story of how it is that the East India Company was able to defeat the major principalities that still existed in India at the beginning of the 19th century. So it tells the story about what went wrong, what were the weaknesses in decision-making capacities and capabilities and virtues of India's political elite and political leadership in the 19th century that allowed the British to actually come out triumphant. So it sort of takes the story back a few decades more.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. The Asian Review of Books podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends, support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with John Sehi, author of The Last Tigers of Hong Kong, True Stories of Big Cats That Stalked Britain's Chinese Colony. But before then, Rahul, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks very much, Nicholas. This was great fun.